Committee on Seniors and Disability, People with Disabilities will come to order, please. We have a couple of information hearings today, and we're going to start with traumatic brain injury, developmentally disabled, and family caregivers. Sherry Stock, would you please come up? Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. President.
Mr. President.
So I am with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and I'm going to talk just generally about caregiving and looking at it more from a family perspective at this point and what's happening in our community. With the right now, about 5% of the Oregon population has disability from a traumatic brain injury. And so we're looking at over 17,000 people in Oregon have this profound disability that need assistance. So what this means to the family, predominantly this group is elderly that are sustaining brain injuries from falls that are ending up mostly in nursing homes for about $6,000 a month. And young people between the ages of 15 and 24 who sustain their brain injuries in automobile accidents, very high number. Young children sustaining their brain injury from learning how to walk to youth in sports. That group falls into the developmentally disabled category and therefore are covered by a lot of by funding from the state. But what this, when you sustain your brain injury as an adult, you don't have funding, and the families are falling, it's falling to the families to be the caregivers if the person isn't moved into a nursing home. And what they're dealing with is personality changes. Brain injuries have severe personality changes, a lot of times behavioral issues. There's fatigue. The family's dealing with somebody they didn't know. They're also dealing with the trauma that they have in having a family member that no longer is going to have the potential they did have. And so I'm going to give illustrations along the way. I have a son who sustained a brain injury at 3 months old in an automobile accident. And he is about 18-month-old level. He's 40 years old and in assisted living home. And he doesn't understand taking a shower or shaving. He can dress himself, and he can feed himself, and he's potty trained. But that's about the limit. And so what does that mean to my family? It means to me, my son will never be there. And to my family, it's missing this person that could have been a productive member of society. And this was from a drunk driver. There's also problems with returning veterans. We have returning veterans whose families are actually identifying that they have a problem, and they're having memory problems. They can't find their car. They can't remember to show up for their kids' activities, and they're more violent. The wives are afraid of them, and they're being identified as having traumatic brain injury, and right now they're falling between the cracks. There is no services for them. We also have some people that there was a young man in Coos Bay who was walking down the street, 23 years old, was beaten by a group of teenagers on a joyride with baseball bats. He's had two young children. They tried to find a place for him because he was violent and his wife and children were afraid of him. And he's now on the street because there was no place for him to go. He wasn't bad enough for a nursing home, and there's so few homes to deal with people with traumatic brain injury. We also have someone, Lance Burke, who sustained a brain injury the same way. He was assaulted. And he's at a place called Homeward Bound. Homeward Bound is in the Cornelius. And they take in people that have severe brain injury, and they work with getting them better to a higher level to be able to go into maybe assisted living or a foster home. And when they take them, they have violent tendencies, and it's a real struggle to get them to a point where they can be on their own. And actually, because of some of the violent activities that this group has, and they're all males, they're on the state has decided to close them down, and they deal with a population that no one else takes. They're the only home like it in the state. So if that one is closed, then Lance Burke and others like him are going to end up probably in nursing homes or prisons.
Now, where is this located?
Homeward Bound is it's run by Carol Altman, and that's in Hillsboro. And actually, there's going to be a hearing, I think it's March 17th, on whether they will close it down or not.
And the reason they're closing it is because?
The various violations, but predominantly it's because some of the people in there can be violent. And that is one of the problems with people with brain injury, especially young men.
So it's a matter of the people who run the home and the way they respond to the violence, is that?
No, I think it's more the people that in the home do an excellent job of responding to problems, because they do everything as a positive reinforcement. Some of their things, for instance, if someone is violent or has some issues that they shouldn't be doing, if they can go a whole day, they'll get a star. If they can go a whole week, then they get a special trip, things like that, very positive reward. I think what it is that the punching and hitting and yelling and screaming happens because these people with the frontal lobe damage, their switches to turn them on and off for inappropriate behavior is broken. So if they feel like hitting each other, they do. And some of the parents don't like that.
So where would they, what would happen to...
If this home is closed?
Yeah.
Right now, I would say the majority will either go home with their family if they can handle them,
okay,
or else they're going to be on the street.
Mr. Chair, I'm still... I'm still not quite sure I understand the reasons that the state is going to close it.
Well, the state has some violations that they've corrected. It's just that the state feels like they didn't correct them quick enough, so they're going to close them.
Okay, there is an incident, there are a couple of facilities that deal with severely abused children, one of them in Lane County, one of them in Medford. Both facilities are, it seems like, under, you know, the microscope in terms of the way that they deal with the violent children. Now, there are certain procedures that the state insists people follow in dealing with, you know, the kind of holds that you put on and so forth. And so I suspect that might be part of the problem. The state feels that the response to the violence is not an adequate response, is what I'm suspecting. How many people
are in? It was a violent.
These are not children, though. These are adults.
No, these are all adults.
Yeah, and
these
how many?
These are all adults that sustain their brain injury as young adults. So
okay,
they're all, I think there are six or eight of them right
six
now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be, I would, when we're through discussing this, I'd like later to get some more information about this, because I'm just kind of curious about what indeed would happen to those people if they would go into a state hospital, maybe?
If there's room.
If there's room.
Yeah, some of them are from the penal system, so they've come out of prison and gone in there because they came out with a brain injury. And this facility, that is their expertise, is getting these people that are violent to be able to learn how to control their violent
yeah,
episodes and to be able to move to the next level. So, but that's one illustration.
Yeah.
Another one is I have, I think it's in Sublimity, an older mother whose children were hit in a crosswalk and both sustained a brain injury when they were children. They are now she's in her 80s and in a wheelchair and no longer able to care for these kids that are in their almost 60, and there's no place for them to go. There are no homes, and she doesn't have the money to pay, and there's only so many homes for people with brain injury. So she is still the caregiver and under extreme duress because physically she's unable to do this.
Okay. Would you talk a little bit about the directory that we have never been able to pull off?
Yeah, so, we were hoping to have a brain injury registry.
A registry, yeah.
And what the registry would do, if it was run through the state, it would be able to track people that sustain the coding, the medical coding for a brain injury.
Okay.
And then send them information and be able to identify really how many people. Right now we're at a guesstimate. The Center for Disease Control says that a certain percentage would have a traumatic brain injury, which is a little over 2% of the population, disabilities from a traumatic brain injury. And then when you add in the other brain injuries, it's close to 5%, so that would be anoxia, lack of oxygen from a heart attack, or a disease, or now the blast injuries, returning veterans. So that brings it up pretty high. And with the registry, we could actually track this. We could find out how many to be able to plan better for the programs that we need, and as well as get information to the families and get them into support groups, because that's a major thing. Families need support. You know, they're depressed, they're under stress, and we now have 48 support groups around the state, but a lot of these people are in rural areas, La Grande, and, you know, out in the country. And there are virtually no services for them.
Now, what's the fiscal impact of that again?
With a disability from a brain injury, you're looking at about $4.5 million per incident.
Now, wait a minute. Excuse me.
Over
to establish the registry.
Oh, if we...
What is it going to cost to establish a registry?
To establish a registry would be about $250,000 biannually.
We've been working on that now for the last,
I think, four sessions.
And it's amazing. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but we did pass last session SJR 21, which makes Brain Injury Awareness Month in March in Oregon. So there is going to be an awareness of this
in March.
In fact, that's when we'll have our conference, which we've moved it for 27 years. It was in October. It will now move to March.
Okay. Well, we will try again next session for the registry. And I guess it wouldn't hurt to remind the Ways and Means co-chairs. Have you... I don't know if anything could possibly happen this interim, but I mean, it would. I think it would be a good thing if you would draft a letter, and I could give it to the co-chairs, or we could see if, you know, just get it on the table.
Okay.
Now, the other end of the spectrum of brain injury, and I forget the doctor's name, the physician, the woman.
Dr. Rehm?
Yes.
Amy Rehm.
So she represents a person with brain injury that you could never tell by either looking at her or in a conversation with her, but her injury prevents her from practicing medicine.
Correct.
And her career was wiped out because...
Trained as an anesthesiologist, so she can't make quick decisions anymore, and she doubts her decisions. You wouldn't want her as your anesthesiologist. And she is... in such a specialty that it's not transferable. She can't go to general medicine or anything because that isn't what she learned. She learned anesthesiology, and which is, we have attorneys, too, that have sustained brain injuries and can't do the multitasking required to be, to practice law. And so it's a real issue. But I have to say that the State of Oregon Voc Rehab Department has the Oregon Competitive Employment Project grant, and we're working actively trying to work out ways to, because in this country you are what your job is. People will ask what you do before they ask your name, and so people want to work. Everyone wants to work in this country. It's part of who we are, and what this project is doing is looking at ways that we can get people back to work, including people with brain injury. Now, my son would not qualify, but if you sustain your brain injury as a young adult, there's a good chance you could go back to work, even if it's part-time. And that would more than make up for the cost of the supports that would have to be in place to have you back to work.
And then a whole another category, which you mentioned at the beginning, in General Caldwell, was we were hoping he could be here to talk about the veterans coming back who have sustained brain injury and are not being treated for it, because it's kind of an invisible thing.
It is. They're not being treated, and they're not getting financial support. So we have one veteran that General Caldwell would have talked about, who is part of the Oregon Guard but actually lives in Idaho, who had a job making about $4,000 a month before he went over there and was injured, and now has come back, and his wife had never worked before, so she is working as a bookkeeper in a truck stop but not making enough, and he's making sandwiches 2 hours a day to try and augment their income. And they're struggling every day of their life. And Alec Geese in Seaside is he was making about $4,000 to $6,000 a month as a contractor, and sustained a brain injury in 2003, and he's not able to work at all. And he is getting disability. In fact, they did move it up to 100% disability, which is very unusual. Usually they give them 10% disability with a brain injury. And but it's still not enough to support his family, and so his wife has gone to work and is working 7 days a week, 5 days for the school district, and 2 days on the weekends she has another job to try and make ends meet. And, you know, when they've put their lives on the line for the country, this shouldn't be happening. But it's something that we'll keep on working on.
Good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do we have a list of...
No, but I would say so.
Yeah.
We have Catherine.
Okay. Catherine, would you come up, please? Yeah, Trudy, would you? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. And we're here today, we have several families here, to talk a little bit about aging caregivers. And these are caregivers of individuals with developmental disabilities. People with developmental disabilities have a long history of waiting for services. In 2000, the Staley lawsuit was filed by families who had been waiting, in many instances, over a decade for services. In the process of the settlement of the lawsuit, there were a number of compromises that were made, and one of those compromises was to limit the access to comprehensive services, 24/7 services, and instead put our emphasis on providing support services to people with developmental disabilities. And that would mean people living at home, providing them with a little bit of funding, some planning, and some assistance for employment, respite, et cetera, for those living at home. But we did agree to limit the number of people who were not in crisis, limit their access into foster care, group homes, other kinds of 24/7 services. And that was part of the compromise that was made in the settlement of the lawsuit. At that time, we identified approximately 250 caregivers who were over the age of 75 who were still doing care for their individuals with disabilities. I think what we want to stress with you today is simply that the same demographic that is occurring in all aspects of our society is occurring for people with developmental disabilities and their caregivers. We have aging caregivers and aging individuals with disabilities. And we believe that we need to be developing a very consistent, very specific strategic plan on how to address the demographic of individuals who are no longer able to continue to care for their family member with disabilities, who will be coming into comprehensive and state services for assistance. And so that was the issue that we wanted to bring to your attention today and have an opportunity for some families to kind of talk about those issues.
Where are we on the payment for the Staley settlement? Where is the state right now? I understand we're not. Go ahead and tell me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Staley settlement continues till 2011. There are still individuals waiting for access to the support services. We will continue to be providing access to those support services. We have 150 people who will get access to comprehensive services, the 24/7 services. But we know that there are hundreds more out there waiting for those comprehensive services, and that's what we were going to address today. But at this point, the Staley settlement continues through 2011, the actual agreement.
And what is the state's requirement, commitment? What is required of the state through 2011?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the state is required to provide services to individuals. Primarily, they're individuals still living in the family home.
Mm-hmm.
And we call those our support services because they're not 24/7. They're services that are provided to adults starting at the age of 18 that will assist them in employment, provide respite or in-home support to the families. That by 2009, individuals will only have to wait 90 days. We still have people who have been waiting for years for services, but in 2009, anybody can come in and they will receive services within 90 days, similar to what currently occurs on the senior and physical disability.
Let me try it one more time.
Okay. Keep going.
What is required of the state of Oregon financially? How much money do we need to put in each year to meet our commitment? Are we meeting our commitment? Are we dragging it out unnecessarily? Well, because we don't have the money. I mean, this is what I'm interested in.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the exact amount of money, I don't know, and I can get that for you. It has been in the budget every year, and it continues to be in the projected budget for 2009-11. So we are confident that the state is fulfilling its commitment in providing the appropriate amount of money. Well, it's never enough money, but... that being said, they are providing the appropriate amount their commitment.
Okay, in a timely fashion.
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Some of my constituents are saying, no, it is not in a timely manner, that they're not getting the money that they should be getting when they need it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, negotiation of the settlement agreement in 2001 when the budget tanked and we went in to renegotiate the settlement, we stretched out the implementation of the settlement.
Okay.
So, yes, indeed, there are people who are waiting longer than any of us would like to wait, but we agreed to do that in an effort to keep the settlement going through 2001 and 2003. When we had such budget problems.
Mm-hmm.
There are also many people, and that's what you're going to hear today, where there is pent-up demand because they have children with more complex needs. The support dollars don't meet their needs. And we have a system right now that the only way to get access to 24/7 comprehensive services is through crisis. You have to be in crisis, and it's a fairly high standard in terms of getting access to services. And so what we are here today is to say we also have a population that needs more service than we're able to give right now, and we are seeing a demographic of aging parents and aging individuals that we need to be aware of.
Okay. Now, I guess my next question is, if we had a financial crisis in 2000, which we did have in 2001, 2003, and we weathered that storm, what if we go into another financial crisis? Will the state meet its commitment this time during that crisis? I mean, that's... kind of the problem is, you know, if there's a shortfall of money, then there are a lot of cuts being made throughout, you know, the service areas and, you know, senior, disabled, and so on and so forth. But how much of a priority will this be, do you think, during a time of crisis to meet the commitment by 2011? That's the problem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do not sense any, at this point, we have no reason to believe that the state would attempt to renege on the settlement agreement. I would say from the perspective of an advocate, I am sure we will all arm up with our attorneys if there is an effort to renege on the settlement agreement. So,
good.
Yeah. I guess I would say this is we've been a very patient group, and
well, and there is a lot of competition for state dollars in the health and human services area, you know, mental health in general, you know, new state hospital, community mental health treatment. You know, we went through a whole thing on the senior issues, long-term care. We're trying to backfill some help there for assisted living. And, you know, there's just all kinds of issues. And I'm not sure what's going to happen in 09. And, you know, things may turn around. Maybe we will not go into a deep recession. It may, you know. The other interesting thing in the state of Oregon, we rely a lot on exports, and the export market is good now because of the, you know, the fact the dollar, the exchange rate is favorable for exports, and Oregon may not have that deep crisis. But I am concerned about this issue, and I'm glad that, you know, you said that you will arm up and make sure the state meets its commitment for this particular issue, and I agree. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Gordon, would you like to come up, please? Gordon Feifel, and introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gordon Teifel.
Well, we can do that. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a father of twins who are 30 years old and normal and above average intelligence. Also, father of this 24-year-old young man who needs help with all living skills, profound developmental disabilities. He's very social. He's compelled with music that makes him happy. Mm-hmm. He's discovered another drum in this room. What it means to be just ahead of the baby boomer age is I'm 62. I miss the boomers by 1 year, excuse me, 1 month and 1 day. So I'm leading the pack. My wife and I have wills. We have gone through financial certified planning series. I am a graduate from Oregon State in industrial arts education, bachelor's and master's. So I'm the researcher, I'm the planner, I'm the organizer, I'm the forecaster. But I can't see a wellness progression from our unlicensed group home into the community unless our family is in crisis. We care for him with great love, day and night. Last night, midnight. Checked him, had to change his diaper, his pad, and that prevents bed sores. It keeps him minimally healthy, but in addition to just taking care of baseline stuff, we take him to pool therapy twice a week. That really gets his body exercised. That's wellness. So he's dearly loved. The emotional state is is very high. His EQ is off the top. If we can't measure his IQ, that's okay. The challenge for us is that we haven't figured out, even though we're involved in the community of DD, affordable housing, for most of 11 years, we've been involved with Families for Independent Living, and we keep bumping up against the brick wall unless we get in crisis, unless I break a leg. I'm much too fit for that to happen, I think. But unless I have an accident or a very serious illness, we have no hope until the gray hairs show up, whatever you can see, until we become so frail that we can't have the same kind of influence. We can't speak up for him in a wellness program. That's what we have wanted all along. So we don't have a crisis and then have actually two crises. One for a parent who can't take care of their son, and then for the son who can't speak up for himself. He's very vulnerable because of his genetic anomaly. In a second nonprofit that I helped to found in 2005, it's called Daytime Enrichment, Activities and Recreation. Our population is his level of skills, profound level. What we want to do is kind of like a preschool for this level of adults. Those families are in the same plight. One has an autistic child, cannot go the next step into moving him into community housing because they're not in crisis. We are very centric to our child. Our family doesn't know normal. We know baseline. We know a baseline. And the baseline is we always have to keep track of Barrett. When I'm off on a nonprofit meeting, my wife's home with him. We have six providers in his brokerage entitlement. One personal companion. There's four others who are care providers, care or respite providers, and one more who's a music therapist. That music therapist is shared with his good friend Hannah, similarly skilled, similarly at home, without a realistic ability to move to community housing. So the challenge is, how does Oregon help us who are nonstop providers? We're not victims, at least I don't think of myself as a victim. But how do we look for the wellness of folks like Barrack, get them into community housing, get them into safe haven, nurturing environments for him to be a music-themed home? It would be a very social home. It'd be a home where it could be within 3 miles of our house so that we could ride our trikes and pull his chariot trailer and drag him along to keep him happy. He loves to be doing things in the community. The worst thing in his future, he'll never have to work a day in his life, by the way, but the worst thing in his future would be boredom, to be left alone, to nap away his existence. That's not a lifestyle. So the challenge for us is that even though we're very prudent, very plugged into the community, very knowledgeable about affordable housing and developmental disabilities, we're stymied. We haven't got a solution for Barrack to get into his own housing. We'll be in his face whenever that does happen. We will still keep him included in church and family activities and so forth. But what a challenge that's repeated. And we need the voice. We need the voice to help us to a solution that that our shallow pockets haven't been able to figure out.
Now, have you? You're in Iowa.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you looked at other states just for models or?
Well, yes.
What models are out there that you would like to see in Oregon?
In September 2005, I went to a Washington, D.C. Summit. 11 national agencies on in this field of disabilities got together, and I was able to find a very unique model in Minnesota that was emulated from a Canadian model, where a family set up an LLC, and they called it PAT, LLC, for, in this case, it would be Barrick LLC, a limited liability corporation. Got it funded, and they conduct their own hiring and firing of the caregivers. He's in his own little home out near the edge of Minnesota and one of its neighboring states. Very small town community. This is a totally different kind of model.
Now, what is the state involvement?
In funding the daily care providers and helping to maintain the mortgage on the property. And there's a second model that really appeals to us called the LARCH. In Portland, there's LARCH Nehalem. This is a community that originated in France, where normally abled people live with folks who are developmentally disabled. The philosophy is around the Catholic culture and nurturing. And if I could talk LARCH Nehalem to build out in Washington County, I would be very, very pleased with that kind of model. Very nurturing model.
What I would be interested in, the Minnesota model now, Minnesota is very progressive in a number of areas, and it seems to me that they also have a program where they assist adult foster homes to provide liability insurance, because it's almost impossible for adult foster homes, depending upon who their clientele is. And I have a friend in Lane County who has 6 schizophrenic patients in his adult foster home, and I don't think he has, I don't even know if he has homeowner insurance, because if you're denied liability, you may be denied homeowner. And so there are a lot of facilities at risk, and I'm trying to get some information from the state of Minnesota on what kind of an indemnity plan they have on that. And I would be interested if you had some specific information on the Minnesota model that we could talk about next session, to see if we can't use some of that Staley money or whatever to implement a plan, a pilot project.
Mr. Chairman, I'll research that.
Yeah, well, and, maybe starting with the pilot project would be a way to go. But, I mean, there's got to be a better way of doing what we're trying to do. I mean, we're not succeeding. And a lot of it is, financial, but still the state, I think, has powers that they might be able to use to indemnify and to assist in some of the humane treatment of the developmentally disabled that you're speaking of, the profoundly disabled. So,
thank you very much.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, good. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
My name's Carla Cudmore, and I'm from Polk County. And I have a daughter, Kaylin. She's 21 years old, but functions at the level of about a one-year-old. She can't walk or talk. She can't feed herself. And she can't use a restroom. She requires extensive lifting. She has limited use of her arms. She has grand mal seizures, and she cannot be left alone. We love her dearly, but she requires a great deal of patience, strength, and time. And we hope she's going to live with us for a long, long time. But we worry, how long are we going to be able to take care of her? When school's over this year, Kaylin will graduate, and she's going to go on to a day program for 4 or 5 hours a day. We're very thankful that we have that. But there's still a lot of hours in every day and every week that she requires complete, total care. And that's the job of her dad and I. But we will wear out, and we are going to die. The lifting, the lack of sleep, the stress, and the depression. Parents of disabled children, it's proven, wear out faster than our counterparts. My husband and I are also part of the now famous sandwich generation, and we still have kids at home, and we also are the sole care providers for a grandparent who is blind with dementia. What's going to happen to our child when we can no longer take care of her? The state of Oregon currently requires that we make the most important decision in our daughter's life when we're at our most vulnerable, when we're in a crisis situation in our life. And when that crisis occurs in our life, if our city or our county doesn't have an appropriate bed available for our daughter, they could place her anywhere in the state. I don't believe crisis management works, and in my view, it's not fiscally responsible either. I think the system has to change and provide access to comprehensive services without crisis. Parents and caregivers need to be allowed to work together and to plan along with the state and counties to transition our children into 24-hour, 24/7 care. By planning comprehensive services, parents and the system can be innovative. Innovative ideas can help retain private insurances, which a lot of kids lose when they are taken out of the homes. It keeps parents involved with their child. It keeps the family and the community ties with the child. I say child, they're young adults, but I think in my mind, my child's always going to be my child. And I think innovation can help allow family resources to be combined with governmental resources to help stretch those rare dollars. There's many of us out here, the baby boomers and older, with our severely disabled kids that are still at home, and we need help. The state of Oregon and the Department of Human Services need to plan for a non-crisis, truly comprehensive approach for adults with developmental disabilities who require 24-hour care 7 days a week. And that's my story.
Thank you. And again, the 09 session is going to be important, and this has got to be a topic of discussion. And I appreciate your being here and urge you to continue your efforts. Thank you.
My name is Marge Turner. I live in McMinnville, and we have a 42-year-old Down syndrome daughter. We've been blessed with the joy that she has brought us throughout these years. And my husband and I are in our 80s, and so our concerns are what's going to happen when we are no longer here. Right now, she has her own apartment, and she has a rather busy life. She has two jobs. One is a volunteer job, and the other one is she works at a health food store for 3 days a week. And they love her there, and she loves doing it because she likes being with people. And I've always said that when Teresa bonds, she bonds with super glue because she will always remember a name and never forget to give somebody a hug. And so she's quite a joy. But I have to reiterate the same as Carla and Gordon, that we have concerns. What's going to happen to them when we no longer are here? And I think they have pretty much said the same thing. I know Teresa is capable of living on her own with help. And I can see that it's lonely when she goes into an empty apartment. So we are looking forward to investigating the LARCH program also. I think it would be ideal for her. I think she would love it. And so, in fact, we have an appointment on Saturday to visit with the executive director of LARCH in Portland. So we're planning on doing that. Other than that, we have really no special needs, extra needs that she doesn't get. She's placed her on a comprehensive list now because of our age, that we were entitled to do that.
Now, don't they have a new assisted living facility in McMinnville that was opened, maybe a 16-unit facility for the developmentally disabled? Are you aware of that?
A new facility.
Now, are you from McMinnville?
McMinnville.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, you're talking about Hendricks Place?
Well, I don't remember the name of it, but I was at an event 2 years ago out at the Catholic Church. That's where they held the event, and the Marion County... I'm not sure which group that was that sponsored it, but that was one of the very proud discussion areas that they did open a facility in McMinnville that I believe allowed for the socialization and the community, you know, the living experiences that you mentioned. But then that's one facility, and there are hundreds of people who need that kind of experience.
Well, we do have Hendricks Place.
Hendricks Place,
and,
that may be
that
the
was
one.
Built 2 years ago.
That was probably the one.
Hendricks Place, and it's for I'm a board member and officer of Families United for Independent Living, and it took us 6 years to get that.
Yeah, that's
that
a model.
Funding.
Yeah,
and it is an assisted living. I mean, it's not assisted. Right. These people live there and they have their own apartment.
Right, right.
And so there's no help that helps them within their living situation.
Okay,
there's no live-in manager.
That would be ideal for your daughter, right?
No, she's there now.
Oh, she is there.
She's there now.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
There are 8 individual apartments.
Okay.
No manager. Now, we also have one that is just going to open up quite soon in Newburgh, and that has 14 tenants.
Okay.
Will be there, and but there's going to be a live-in manager there.
Okay, so. But that is great for that level of disability where they do have the socialization and they work and they come and go and so on and so forth.
She's on the go all the time. She's very social, but at the same time, it's not going to be a lasting thing because what's going to happen to her when she when she ages and there is no help. But this is our main concern.
Well, that's interesting because what's the age group of the occupants of that particular facility? Are they all about middle?
The youngest, I believe, is 20. I think Teresa is the oldest at 42.
Okay. Well, do people have to leave there at a certain age?
No.
No. Okay.
There's nothing in the plans for that.
Okay.
But the parents are concerned, and they don't, with their disabilities, a lot of them don't step forward and invite people in. Mm-hmm. One might, but it's not something that they can come up with themselves. Somebody has to organize for them. And
was that a Catholic Community Services effort that
families
to create that?
No, that's part of the brokerage, ISN and Catholic Community Services.
Well, the event that I attended a couple of years ago was a fairly large event. There were a lot of representatives, there were legislators there. There were people from the cities, the counties, the state, and so on and so forth. And it was an effort to promote that particular type of living facility, which...
Because we did have a big open house
before
we had that.
But unfortunately, there are not enough facilities, and that only covers... Well, that does not cover the profoundly disabled people.
Oh.
That's a whole different thing. And again, I guess I would just suggest that, you know, when the next session starts, that you prepare, you know, the material that you have or the requests that you have, and just... give it your best shot again and hope that the state will come through with the funding.
And we appreciate your support in the past.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Okay. Others wishing to testify on this issue? Seeing none, we will close our public hearings, and we are adjourned.